This is K2 Romeo, India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You'll also hear John. You'll also hear John, KC2WGB. John and Dick act as co-net control operators for the technical net. The main purpose of the technical net, we think, is education. We try to tap into all of that brain power that exists in the New York City tri-state area, metropolitan area of New York, New Jersey, Connecticut, which is the area that this theater has moderately good coverage of. And in that area, there are people who have got quite a bit of experience on things like transmission lines and antennas and transmitters and receivers and propagation and satellites and IRLP and Echolink, and it just goes on and on. There's 25 or 26 different kinds of ham radio. And we try to discuss quite a few of those from time to time. A person signs into the technical net by giving John and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, KC2BHY, Jim, and yes. So that's the way you sign in. Now, what we try to do, let me drop. For those who sign in during that first hour, we make a sincere attempt to give everybody at least a brief answer to their particular question or comment. At the end of that hour, John goes to the mailbag for the people who don't yet have a ham license or for whatever reason are unable to get to the net live. What John and Dick are promising is that we do the best we can to gather that brain power and give an answer to your question during that during the TechNet itself. We're not necessarily offering a free consulting service during the rest of the week. There are people who would like to believe that, and it's a little bit above and beyond the call of duty. The majority of what the TechNet is a live give and take during the TechNet itself, of the gathering of the clan, if you know what I mean. The slight exception to that is that for the new guys who don't yet have a license and have questions as to some of the very basic things that we all wanted to know in the beginning, and when they mail John a letter by snail mail, email, or whatever, we make an attempt to answer those, and John will choose about three of those that he has received during the week, and we cover those at the end of the first hour. After John's three mailbag situations, we then go over to Paul, WS2N, a space expert, who tells us what the National Aeronautics and Space Administration has been doing during the last week. At the end of those two first approximate hours, we then go into deeper material, which has a more limited, usefulness is not the right word, let's call it interest. In other words, some of the deeper up areas of physics and things like this we go into during the end of the TechNet. And not everyone is pleased with that. Now, when it comes to people who can't stay up late enough to hear the TechNet, and they want to, there's a solution to that. There's a beautiful website done by Mike Perry, KC2, November, Juliet, India. And he has recorded the last 6.5 years of TechNet. That website with his recordings has been hit 200,000 times. You can get to that website and listen to the past recordings of TechNet by going to www.amateurradio.tangovictor. That's the web address. And there you can select the year, the month, the week, and the hour. They're in 1 hour reels, and you can listen to those. What some people do is to put those pieces of material on their recording device and listen to it while they're driving to work or on their lunch hour and things like that. There are college professors that are telling their students that you can get an acquaintance for what the real world of wireless technology is like by listening to the TechNet. As I said, there are college profs telling their students that. We've heard feedback along those lines. Sometime in the middle of September will be the 30th anniversary of the technical net. Somewhere in the middle of September of 1982 was the first TechNet. This TechNet you're listening to right now, we believe, is approximately 1,415 of the series. Okay, now time for the sign-in. So give me your call letters and your name. Try to remember your name, because I'm so darn forgetful. And the word yes. You need not sign in just because you're listening. After 30 years, 29 years, we believe somebody is listening. Give me a call letters and name right now. K2RIW.
K2YO.
Say yes. Say sure. Yes.
Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta, John, yes.
And 2XCN for the first hour, yes, and after the poll, yes.
KDD Bill, and yes.
Okay, I heard Bernie first, K2YO. Then, before Tom, Bravo Delta. There was another person in there. Who was that person between Bernie and...
It was Beetle.
Okay, yes. Our man from Bayshore. Okay. Vito, why can't I think of his call letters right now?
W-A-2-P-J-F.
Okay. Proper Juliet Foxtrot. And I've forgotten the funny call letters I've used for you. Okay, number 2, Bravo Delta. And Tom, what is your prefix to your call letters?
It's Kilo Delta 2, Bravo Delta. Name is John, and I have a follow-up from last week.
Yeah, we're looking forward to that, John. So we got Bernie, Vito, John, Wesley, and Bill. Bill was something NP. Give me your full call letters, Bill.
Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike Papa.
Okay, Kilo Delta 2, Charlie Mike Papa. We got you. And is there anyone else we've missed?
This is KC2, Quebec Yankee Whiskey. Name is Joe, and no.
Okay, Joe with an L. Bernie, haven't heard from you for quite some time. And you're the guy that's usually getting the answers. Why in the world would you be asking us a question, Bernie? K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RAW on the TechNet.
Good evening, Dick. Looking for a little equipment advice. I'm back doing some surface mount work, and let's just say I know the rest of you guys aren't getting older, but I am. So need to upgrade my optics a little bit. I'm just curious, anybody with any experience of doing surface mount work or rework with using one of the stereoscopes? Right now I just have the flip-up visors that you wear around your head like a headband is flipped down, and those do work. But it forces you to get awfully close to the work when you're doing it. You end up sucking up a lot of solder fumes or flux fumes, etc. So just curious if anybody has any experience or suggestions on ways to get some more optical resolution when you're doing surface mount stuff.
Hey, Bernie, I think you came to the right place. When it comes to surface mount components, 0402s, 0604s, 0603s, and so on, I've been doing that kind of work essentially every single day for the last 8 or so years. And I'm doing it with a Bausch & Lomb stereo zoom microscope. And I think, believe it or not, you only need about 20 or 30 power, and most of the time a little bit less than that. However, when you do it with a stereo zoom microscope with the right kind of illumination, you get a picture of the tiny little whiskers, the wicking of the solder, the proper placement of the component. Boy, you see things that you cannot get any other way. I've used the flip-up type, headband type magnifiers. I know that Eric, K2EJ, thinks that that's good enough. Well, for Eric's rather good set of eyes, and in my youth, I used to be able to focus at the end of my nose. My focus would be that close if I wanted to. So all I had to do is get my head close enough to the object, and I was getting a magnified view. Well, that was the good old days. As we all get older, our eyes decrease. Let me drop. There's an amazing number of guys, Bernie, who think that they can no longer do fine work as they get older. As long as your hands don't have a whole lot of shake, and even if they do, you can find ways of compensating for that. But as long as you've got some method of getting the manual dexterity, the right kind of small tools, you know, tweezers and very small cutters and needle nose pliers and so on, the right kind of soldering machine, and the right kind of visual with enough magnification. No matter how bad your eyes are, as long as you've got some kind of eyesight, you've got a bright enough illumination, and the right kind of stereo zoom, you will see it all. I managed to buy a surplus stereo zoom microscope at a surplus house in Ohio when I was there. Was it Ohio? No. That was Utica. I was in Utica near the Rome Air Development Center. And right in Utica, they got a beautiful surplus house, and I think I paid $150 for it, and the guy probably expected me to talk him into a lower price. I was so happy to get it, I just bought it, no questions asked. Been very happy with it ever since. And when it comes to illuminating the work itself, the normal forward illumination, a ring material around the nose of the microscope, does a medium good job, but gives you low contrast. If you eventually someday downrange, Bernie, you manage to get a fiber optic pair of illuminators. I've got a device that was given to me by a good friend which has got a bright light bulb going into a fiber optic splitter, into two separate fiber optic flexible leads. And you put those on the left side and the right side so that they're aimed at the work at a shallow angle. My goodness, do you get a beautiful three-dimensional picture. So the bottom line of all this is buying the right optical equipment. As long as you've got any eyesight left at all, it's going to do 90% of the job, Bernie. So take your own sweet time buying that stereo zoom microscope, and common sense would lead you to believe...
Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Common sense would lead you to believe you have to go all the way up to a magnification of 70 or 100. I absolutely do not. Most of the time you're going to find that magnification of about 20, 25 in that neighborhood is more than enough if it's really stereo zoom with both eyes and the right kind of illumination. You don't need great magnification, but you want to be using both eyes in a stereo manner with a lot more magnification than you can get with the headband eye loops situation. And also the nice thing about the stereo zoom microscope is that when you're doing soldering under those conditions, the solder is not drifting up straight into your nose, so to speak. You've got quite a bit of distance between your face and the actual work. And the smarter guys would use some kind of an exhaust fan to make sure that the solder fumes are not going straight into their face. These are some of my recommendations. There may be other people with other recommendations, Bernie, so drag your feet a little bit as I pass it back to you. K2 Yankee Oscar, with anyone else who's got more info, K2RIW in the TechNet.
WGB with a comment.
Go right ahead, John.
Dick, everything you said is exactly right, and the reason you want to go for something like the Bausch & Lomb, you need the eye relief on the ocular, because it is extremely important. If you're going to spend any time looking through a microscope, you want the widest port for your eye, and that's where the money goes. You can get a 20 mag unit that'll be very cheap, but the eye relief is so bad, you could work 15, 20 minutes to be exhausted. So that's one thing to look forward to, Bernie. You want to get something with the most eye relief you can get. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
Very good point, John. And another main advantage of having a lot of eye relief is not only is it a lot easier to place your head and you get a much greater field of view. It's nice to have, let me pick a number, 60 degrees field of view from the apparent field of view when you're looking at the eyepiece. But with the greater eye relief, that really means how far away from the output exit optical thing that your eye can be and still see the image clearly. With greater eye relief, you can now wear your normal glasses with their astigmatism correction, and that can help a lot. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2RIW on the TechNet.
One more bit of fill, Dick. How would you, when you're reading specifications, how would they be measuring eye relief? How would you know one unit is better than another?
I think they give you millimeters of eye relief. Is that approximately the way it's done, John? You bought yours more recently, and you probably, if I know you, you bought a brand new one. I bought a used one which came with no instruction manuals. KC2WGB, K2LAW.
Yes, it's going to be a factor of your magnification and the diameter of the ocular. You'll see it in like maybe 10 millimeters or 11 millimeter in diameter. You want to get as wide as you can for the power you're buying, and you'll see that's where the money really goes. But you can get used. Bausch & Lomb is excellent. Lights, Exela. There's quite a few brands that do excellent, and the clarity is there. So, yeah, and you're right, Dick. No matter how bad your... My eyes are pretty rough, and mine goes from 0 to 80, which is far more than you need. 20 should be perfect for anyone with normal vision problems.
Now, part of what's going on here, Bernie, is that if you measure the diameter of the iris of a human eye, a very young eye that is dark adapted, the iris will open up to 7 millimeters, 0.7 centimeters. And on a bright sunny day, it goes down to, you know, 1 millimeter or something like that. So the greater than 7 millimeters that you can get of eye relief, diameter of the exit pupil, that means you don't have to position your head so accurately. You can move your head around left and right, up and down, and so on, and still be in the field of view of what's going on. So I guess the diameter of exit pupil is one of the main ways of describing eye relief. there probably is another definition of distance between the front of your eye and the exit pupil, but I don't think I've seen that one stated as a specification. So diameter of eye relief of the exit pupil probably is the main one you're looking for. Over to you, Bernie, K2RIW. And by the way, Bernie, as you do select one, and some of the Japanese-made ones are very good, Martian Loam is the best, to my knowledge, in domestic, but there's quite a few foreign ones that are also very good. So as you do select one and start using it, please come back and let us know what you found, what it costs, and do check on eBay, because some of the used ones are an extremely good buy. What else was I going to ask you? That's the main thing. And if need be, I can let you look through mine to show you what it should look like, if you know what I mean. K2 Yankee Oscar, K2 RIW.
Excellent, I thank you. This gets me headed in the right direction. So I'll start plowing around the net looking for, say, like a 10 to 30 zoom set, and also take a look at what kind of lighting options they have. Once I find some, I'll shoot you or John a link and have you guys kind of take a look at it and see if that's the right quality. It sounds like the usual, shall we say, good optics providers are the suspects that would make these things also. The names that John mentioned, I know all as good lens makers. So, very good. And I would definitely, to anybody out there, recommend, if you're comfortable with soldering through lead stuff, try surface mount. There are some wonderful surface mount kits out there. It is not difficult. It is not expensive either. My first surface mount kit, I built it using this my standard soldering iron. Now, granted, I've got a little bit better than an average soldering iron, but still not a bloody expensive one. And it's absolutely possible. Once I did it, got my feet wet and kind of became intoxicated with it, I did get a hot air machine for my birthday last year for rework stuff. One last thing I highly recommend, if you're going to do surface mount, do not take a nice espresso basement drink down to the basement with you to keep you company. I tried that a few nights ago, and it was a disaster.
Further comment, Dick?
WJ2B with another comment. J2B recognized. John first. Go ahead, John.
Dick, what Bernie should watch out for is also, if he can, get a tri-head, which gives him the opportunity to mount either a 35mm camera with the correct lens converters or a CCD camera, because he may want to watch it on television as he's doing it, and you can do that, especially with the Marshall Loam stuff. That's another. And it's not that much more money because you're buying used, and most people don't use that feature, so it's not really a price booster. Back to you, Dick, KC2WGB.
For anybody, I'm going to go to Joe in a second. For anybody starting out with surface mount components, they'll soon discover that the microscopic world, or the almost microscopic world, behaves very differently. Wow. When you're doing work like that, you'd like to build a moat around the printed circuit board you're working on to make sure that you catch the component that you are trying to position. Because unless you're very skilled, you'd be amazed how easy it is to create the tiddlywink situation. You're pressing down on the component to try to hold it in position while you solder, and it decides to jump to the end of the earth somewhere, and you'll never find it with a moat built around it. Some kind of a fence, a small fence built around your work position, allows you to possibly confine the component. But in the microscopic world, things behave very differently. There's a huge learning curve. The first few hours you do it, you will be frustrated, and you'll think that it's you, and you'll think you haven't got the skill and you can't acquire it. Hang in there. Don't give up. As I said, it's a real learning curve of how you position and the procedures you use for doing soldering of one side at a time, or doing desoldering with solder wick, or if you've got the right kind of double iron, so to speak, to remove a component. There's a whole skill set required, and it takes a while. But once you've made that investment, because almost all the electronics you can touch nowadays has surface mount components, individual RCO7 resistors are almost a thing of the past. Don't give up, even though you're going to be frustrated in the beginning. Joe, WJ2B, what do you recommend? You've got it, Joe, K2LIW.
How's it going, everybody, at WJ2B? I just want to comment that what John said about the eye relief is very important, because depending on how good your eyes are, how bad they are, you might not be able to focus well if you don't have enough eye relief. And Usually it's hard to find that speck on a lot of microscopes, because it's usually a speck of the eyepiece, not of the whole microscope itself. So unless you can find the specks on a particular eyepiece that's installed in the microscope, and you know, usually that's only specked on very expensive microscopes. The cheaper ones are very hard to even find that speck. But my best recommendation is to actually try to get your hands on the one you're going to use. If you buy it off eBay, that's kind of a tough thing to do to be able to try it first. You might have to tell the guy, hey, if I don't like it, can I return it? But the best thing, like you said, is go to a surplus store, get your hands on it, try it out, bring something small that you can try it out, look at it, and piece maybe print a circuit board. Make sure it works well with your eyesight, because I've seen a lot of people have difficulty with doing close-up stuff, and certain microscopes work for them, certain ones don't, certain magnifiers don't work better than others, so you really have to try it out to make sure it's going to work well for what you want to do there, which is obviously tough to do on eBay. Easy to do that at a store. Rebecca, what do you think? WJ2B.
K2YL.
Bernie, recognized. Go ahead, Bernie.
Are there any surplus stores here on the island that would carry that kind of stuff?
What do you think, Joe?
Boy, that's a good question. I know companies usually have that kind of equipment that do any type of manufacturing. I don't know of any stores off the top of my head. Maybe that guy in Syosset, Elbelco or something. There might be a couple of parts stores that are still around. I don't think Radio Shack would have anything that's that high a quality. They have mostly low-quality magnifiers there. But to get something on that, well, like Dick is talking about, a surplus unit and around $100 to $200, I don't really know of anywhere around here. Maybe somebody else out there might.
If it exists anywhere, it's going to exist in one of the five boroughs of New York City. John, is there any kind of a surplus house in the five boroughs of New York City that you've heard of that might have a piece of equipment like this? KC2WGB, K2LAW.
No, but a good shot would be like J&R. They would know. They deal with optics, and they probably have a house. But I'll tell you what I did, and Bernie has got connections, so he may be able to do this. I have spoken to the phlebotomists, and every once in a while, they renew the equipment in the laboratories, and the purveyors just dump them at almost, I mean, ridiculous with cheap prices. They just want to get rid of them. So there is a good place to get a zoom-type microscope. They do not use extreme high powers. They've got a lot of 20s and 30s, some 50s, but that is an excellent place. Any medical purveyors.
That's a good lead. And there was a man who sent me a series of emails a year or so ago, and he was investigating various candidate microscopes, film microscopes that he was seeing on eBay. And his problem was, at that time on eBay, there were too many choices. Not that there were too few, too many choices. And he was asking my recommendations. And most of the choices went up to extremely high numbers, like 75 and 100. You don't need super high magnification. Very similar to a person buying their very first telescope. They think the number of magnification of the telescope is the most important number. And dealers, particularly inexpensive mail order dealers will respond to that by claiming great big numbers, which are unusable. So the amount of magnification is not the main thing. Alrighty, any other questions for you, Bernie, before we go on? And so I think eBay is going to be your greatest possibility. K2IO for any other comments? K2RAW?
Well, thank you, gentlemen, all of you. It's been very helpful, and I will report back what I find. So off we go on a new adventure. Thanks, guys. K2L.
I'll take a quick tip on surface mounting.
Go ahead, John.
You know, everyone seems to have a problem with the tweezers and the damn it where to go syndrome. What I've done to resolve that, I've worked several different things. I took a pair of chopsticks and double back tape and a paper punch, punched out the little circles, peeled it back, stuck it on the end of the stick, chopstick, and stuck it on the part. It peels right off and leaves very little residue. You could remove it with isopropyl alcohol, but that's what I've done, and it seems to have solved the problem. Also, you can attach the chopstick to your mechanical arm to a whole different place while you do your work. So that, I found that a good way for me. Back to you, Dick.
I've also watched the professional people use a toothpick, a very fine toothpick with some kind of sticky stuff. They put a little dab of it down on the board where the middle of the component is going to be, not in the actual contacting area. And so with some kind of sticky stuff to hold the component, that something is, you know, an inert material, that also works, because you're going to discover that as you solder down a component, when the component is small enough, the capillary action, the wicking action of the solder on the end of the soldering iron, is such that it's got a huge amount of attraction. As you pick up the soldering iron after you've done the heating and soldering, you'll find out that the component wants to follow you. It wants to go up with the iron and come away from the board. It doesn't want to stay there. That capillary action is huge. So the sticky stuff or some other kind of a holder. Other guys have also created an extremely miniature tripod-like thing with a little something like a movable toothpick on the end of it to create a continuous pressure on the component, holding it down before it's being soldered. So there's various tricks. Each one has its own way of doing it, but there's a huge learning curve there. And the components, boy, are they persnickety in the beginning. Okay, Vito, what's going on over there in Bayshore? W2PJF, K2RIW in the TechNet. You got it, Vito.
Okay, good evening, Professor. I'm very happy to hear you on again this evening. My question is very simple and not technical this evening. However, it's quite out of the ordinary. Since it's been a while since I last spoke to you, all I want to know is that are you and your family safe these days and in good health, I'm hoping. That's all I have to ask. Back to you.
Unusual question, but yes, we are, Vito. A number of various things are changing with us, and there are people complaining that during the week they can't get a hold of me, and I understand that. This is not many people trying. I just can't respond to them all. I'm volunteering 4 hours per Sunday night on the technical net, but I'm not volunteering a whole lot of other time. So, I don't think I've got a problem along those lines. Nobody, to my knowledge, has been attacking us financially, psychologically, physically, whatever. So we're in moderately good health. Me and my wife wish we were a couple of pounds lighter, but what else is new? And one-third of our close friends have already died. That's a little bit discouraging, but that happens when you're beyond 70 years of age, so to speak. And I still work every day. My wife still works as a college professor, so as long as we keep eating right, sleeping right, and in my case, not eating too much sodium, salt, and so on, high fiber, lots of low cholesterol, high fiber diet, we think it's going to continue for a while. Thank you for asking, and I better pass it back to you for one quick question. What made you worry about this one, Vito? W2PJF, K2RIW.
Well, the reason being is that, as you know, things are not favorable these days in our country in particular, and various and sundry situations prevail with various people, whatever they may be. A lot of them losing their jobs for one thing and can't put food on the table, can't pay their bills, and not getting any better. And I usually strike up a conversation with people, even people at home, people I work with in the cafeteria, we talk. And I always ask, how are things with you? Has something happened? Would you care to share an unfavorable or favorable experience? And I just thought I'd ask that. I know I'm tying things up. It's very foolish. People are probably saying this guy's a nut. But anyway, that's the only thing. I'm a praying person. I'm a very religious person. I go to church almost every day and praying for help, and I pray for everybody. And I worry, and I think, and that's the whole thing. And you are such a fine person over the years that I've heard you on the air. I just had to say something. Back to you.
Okay. Without a doubt, there's a man with compassion. Vito has mailed me two very large packages, maybe even three, of various kinds of information that he believes I would benefit from having. I thank him for that. So Keep up the good work, Vito, and we're going to try to hang in there also. I have a motivation to do that. See you down the line. John, KD2, Bravo Delta, tell me what's going on in, I keep forgetting the name of the place, Seagirt, but the name of your town is right on the right-hand side of your, yeah, there it is, Wall Township. So the microwave voice of Wall Township, what's newest with you, John? KD2VD, K2RAW, in the tech band.
K2RAW on the TechNet from KD2BD. Well, my reason for checking in tonight is not having to do with microwaves, but medium waves and long waves, because last week Joe, RYY, asked the question about coupling an external loop antenna to an AM radio and how that improves reception, and I chimed in saying, yeah, I've done that, and it does work. And then you asked me, well, approximately how many dB of gain or improvement do you get in a situation like that? And I said about 15, but I really didn't know. So I did an experiment, and I measured the improvement, and it comes out to be about 30 dB. I took a loop stick from an old AM radio, and I coupled it to a receiver that I built, and I resonated it with a variable capacitor, and I took a measurement of signal strength on WCBS, 880 kilohertz. And I got that measurement, and then I took a air core loop that I described last week, 84 feet of wire, 10 turns, and I coupled that, resonated it to 880 kilohertz, and put it in close proximity to the AM loop stick, and I saw a 32 dB increase in signal strength. And then I tested this at 540 kilohertz, and I saw a 28 dB increase in signal strength. So I'm going with 30 as being a good ballpark figure. K2REW on the TechNet from KD2BD.
Well done, John. That's a real experiment with, you know, hardcore laboratory measurement data. And where I was coming from, what led me astray last week is that an infinitesimal dipole has essentially within half a dB the exact same gain as a full-size dipole. If I made a dipole on 80 meters, 132 feet long at a reasonably high altitude, and then I shrunk it down to, let me pick a number, 32 feet instead of 132 feet, and properly re-resonated with low-loss materials, I'll get essentially the same gain. There's the catch. I wasn't aware of the fact that the miniature loopstick antennas that are inside of our pocket-type transistor radios have efficiency numbers like, I think you were saying last week, numbers like 5%. Because of the low efficiency, because you are getting resistive loss within that resonator, now taking a much higher Q, larger resonator nearby and coupling it to it can make an improvement. So it is a violation of one of the premises I've always been using when using low-loss materials. And I think that's the clue. And so by various means, with that loop stick that you got, you can measure its 3 dB bandwidth, John, and the usual one of the definitions of Q, there's five definitions of Q, let me drop. One of the definitions of Q is center frequency divided by bandwidth. If the loop stick is resonating at one megacycle, winds 1010 New York, so to speak, resonating at one megacycle, and if your particular 3 dB bandwidth, half power bandwidth, when you measure it on that resonator, happened to be 100 KC wide, 100 KC divided into one megacycle would be a 10-to-1 ratio, you'd have a Q of 10. That great big multiple sheet of wire in that 10-turn loop of yours, if you remeasure its 3 dB bandwidth, and you get a much smaller number, like 10 KC of bandwidth instead of 100 KC of bandwidth, half power bandwidth, that would be a Q of 100 instead of a Q of 10. And that would be a 10-to-1 voltage rate increase. That would be a 20 dB of increase, 100-to-1 power increase. And so I think that's what you can confirm. By measuring the bandwidth of your... You've done the direct measurement, measuring real signal strength on the loop by itself and then when coupled to your larger resonator. Now by measuring the individual bandwidths, you'll get the next step of confirmation. And I think you've got a beautiful confirmation here, Joe. And I know you've also told me that was in the second issue of Krause's Antenna Engineering Handbook, which I said last week I was going to look at that, but didn't get a chance to do that. Well done. And so Once again, we've learned something by this one, Joe. KD2BD, great experiment. K2LIW in the TechNet.
Sounds like you've given me a homework assignment. I didn't measure Q of either the loop stick or my 10-turn loop. I did measure inductance, though. The ferrite loop stick had a pretty high inductance of 665 microhenries. My 10-turn loop had an inductance of 242 microhenries, which is about right for a 365 picofarad capacitor to tune from one end of the band to the other. Now maybe I'll try doing that one of these days. One of the things I did try, which kind of surprised me, is when I set this up and I coupled the external loop close to the ferrite loop stick and I saw the signal level that it was getting out of the receiver. At one point, I disconnected the loop stick and connected my receiver directly across my external 10-turn loop, and I got very close to exactly the same signal strength. So the degree of coupling between those two antennas is very high. And there is still is, of course, some pickup from the ferrite loop stick itself, and I can tell that because when I'm tuning the external loop antenna, as I get it close to resonance, just before I get it into resonance, I see a dip in signal strength. So I'm guessing that that's an out-of-phase condition between with the larger loop is picking up and re-radiating, and with the ferrite loop stick is picking up all on its own. K2RW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
Of all the definitions of Q in the world, one of them really tells you a higher Q circuit for a fixed level of signal input has a much stronger circulating current, a much stronger local electromagnetic field. In other words, the field goes further. If I got to very high Q circuits, I can have a ridiculously large distance between the two, and they will be electronically coupled. Conversely, if I'm using very low Q circuits, I've got to get them physically very close before they couple very well. So your external circuit is so much higher in Q, it's got such a great big field around it, that coupling it to your loop stick is relatively easy. That's my hypothesis. So when you go and measure those bandwidths, did you get a chance to do that? I didn't intend to give you a homework assignment, but that would really close the loop, if you know what I mean. If the bigger circuit with the lower loss materials has a higher Q, which I think it has, and the LC ratio is not necessarily the main factor. I think it's a minor factor, whether it's a big capacitor, small inductor, or vice versa. As long as the circulating current is experiencing very low loss, then by definition you've got high Q, and you've got all this desirable characteristic. Good thing to know. So for a person who wants to do AM radio DXing, that high Q circuit has sharper directivity, where you could null out an undesired signal by properly orienting things in the XYZ space, and also gives you a larger capture area and more signal to pick up. Beautiful. Anyone else want to add something to this? Give me your call letters right now. K2RAW on the TechNet.
Hey, this is Y. Just wondering what tool you're using to measure DB gain.
Okay, that was an extremely weak signal. I didn't hear your call letters, but he said, what tool did he use to measure the gain? He connected his loop stick to the equivalent of a homebrew radio, and he was measuring signal strength on either a galvanometer or an oscilloscope, and then he was measuring the amplitude of the signal when he added this larger loop stick-like thing, this larger resonator nearby. I presume you're actually measuring voltage out of the radio, so to speak. Is that true, John? KD2BD, K2LAW?
Yeah, that is correct. The receiver is a quadrature phasing direct conversion receiver. I use it for doing on-air frequency measurement tests. And the output of that receiver is 1 kilohertz tone when I tune into the radio station's carrier, and that was measured on a Tektronix 465 scope.
Well done. Now, you're using a direct conversion quadrature demodulator. Does that setup of yours, Joe, have John, does it have the ability to be set up as a synchronous demodulator? Over to you, John.
Yeah, I could do that. In fact, that's the method that I use to measure the carrier frequencies of on-air signals during the frequency measurement tests. but that's not what I did in this case. In this case, my local oscillator was just a function generator that was tuned to approximately four times the carrier frequency. And the reason for that multiplication is because inside the receiver there's a flip-flop that does the, gives me four outputs at 0 degrees, 90 degrees, 180, 270, which feed switching mixers, which give me my I and Q demodulators, and then there are amplified filters. There's a 90 degree audio phasing network in there, which is really simple since it's a narrow band receiver. The band of the receiver is only 50 hertz, so that phasing network is very simple. And then they're combined together, and I can either select an upper sideband or a lower sideband injection and figure out what I want to do based on that. K2RW in the TechNet from KD2BD.
I have a problem with it. The bandwidth is 50 hertz.
That's very well, John. What you've actually got there is a full vector demodulator. And in the case of a full vector demodulator, now you've got the ability to look at almost anything you want. Very well done. And some of the better receivers these days that are being used for, let's say, for instance, radio frequency identification receivers are vector demodulators. Very well done. Okay, Wesley was the next one with a question. N2XJN, go right ahead, Wes. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, well, at first I had a comment about that experiment the gentleman gave to us. I was kind of confused with 50 hertz bandwidth versus four times signal from the generator. Couldn't go there. The bandwidth is too small.
Well, it turns out that an amplitude-modulated AM signal, a broadcast signal, has a real significant carrier and an upper and lower sideband, which is the modulation. With a 50 hertz noise equivalent bandwidth receiver tuned to the carrier, that's an extremely accurate way of measuring carrier amplitude independent of the modulation. If you're not real careful, the bandwidth of your receiver could be encompassing the modulation as well as the carrier. And believe it or not, when an AM radio goes from no audio going into the microphone, let's assume now that I'm running a 1,000 watt broadcast station, 1,000 watt carrier power broadcast station, and no one is speaking into the microphone, and now somebody whistles into the microphone a 1KC note at full amplitude, 100% modulation, the total power output of that AM broadcast station is no longer 1,000 watts, it's 1,500 watts. 50% increase in total power output because of the energy you put into the side lobes, the side bands. So by him using a 50 hertz noise equivalent band but looking at only the carrier, he's now making a measurement independent of modulation and therefore getting a more exact number. He was putting in a carrier to his circuit four times higher in frequency because his circuit has a 4-to-1 frequency divider built into it. The frequency divider is there in order for him to have the equivalent of four separate carriers that he can work on during the demodulation process that are at 90, 180, 270, and 0 degrees phase shift, so to speak. So he's got a full vector demodulation receiver there, and it's a very classy way of doing things. Into XJN, K2RIW.
Thank you very much for that explanation. Now I understand. Question that I have. VK3UM, I have sent you two screenshots. The transmission line calculator, that's one of them, and the other one is the EME performance calculator. I believe it's kind of an interesting fact. The calculator. I would like you to give a few words on it. I sent you the specs, the scope shot on it, so you would be able to say more about it. What puzzles me is, I understand it's mostly for UHF and VHF and over 1 gigahertz frequencies and for the moon bouncing, but why that the minimum frequency is 50 hertz on it? Let's start from the performance calculator and to XGF.
Okay, yeah. One of the things you've mailed me during the week was a whole long list of YouTube videos. And I looked at a few of those, and it would take an awful lot of time to go through all of them. So the items you're now discussing, Wes, you're going to have to pose a more exact question because I probably haven't seen that one yet. Back to you, Wes.
Look, the assumption of mine was that it is so simple for you, so you don't have to prepare for yourself. I sent you like 2 hours ago this email, the last one, and you can look at it. It was you, Glenn, I believe, and John that I addressed it to. And it does have a true screenshot. As you're using a Unix system, it is not like it displays the text and the shot at the same email. I believe so, correct me if I'm wrong. But actually you have to click and download it. So if you can look at that. Extremely nice quality piece of software. And I wish plenty of people would like to have it and to use it.
Okay, did you give this to Bernie so that other people can look at it at the same time?
Correct. There was name material for the TechNet. So if you go to the email, it is being called, sent email, TechNet 9.9-12, how to use performance calculator. But you see the screenshots, actually three of them. One is VK3UM, which is the showing what software does he have. EME calculator, EME planner, vibration calculator, EMR calculator, atmosphere, which is another question of mine. What makes the radio wave dissipated? Which part of the atmosphere component? Integral filter impedance calculator. Beautiful impedance calculator. I love it. And then you have another shot, which is the impedance calculator. And then the third shot, the big one, is the performance calculator.
Yeah, Doug, VK3UM, Doug MacArthur, I think his name is a very famous guy in Australia who has been doing moonbounds for many years, decades worth. And I think in the early days he was the guy that had the triple or quadruple rhombic, three or four stacked rhombics on a 1,000-foot-long antenna range.
I think that was VK5MC that had that.
Very fine, Barry. Barry, give us a few words on what your experience was with Doug VK3UM. I think he has written quite a few pieces of software that help people find three-dimensional aiming of an antenna in order to find the moon at a particular hour, a particular day, for a particular location. Is that true, Barry? M2 Moonbounds, K2RIW?
You know, I probably never read any of his stuff, so I know very little about the guy, seriously. I know he was early in Moonbounds. But I just had to throw that little comment in because I remember VK5MC had what we call stack rhombics.
Give us a couple of words on how those stack rhombics behave, if you remember, Bob, Barry. I vaguely remember that when the moon walked through the main lobe of that antenna, I'll bet you he had 33 or so dB of gain out of that thing. I think it was on 2 meters, I believe. When it comes to southern Australia, I believe he was the big voice at that time. Is that true, Barry? And two moonbounds, K2RIW?
Absolutely. He had one rhombic in front of the other. And I worked the guy. He had a fantastic signal. He always claimed he's only running 100 watts. To this very day, I have trouble believing that, I got to tell you. Because he had a beautiful sideband signal. Sometimes I would sit there. By the way, his window on the moon was very narrow. I think he was good for about 25 or 30 minutes, 2 days a month, and that was it. It was a very short window because he couldn't move the thing. You know, he had no way to move the antenna. It was quite large, and he eventually had to quit with that antenna. The problem was that they had some kind of a development near him, like a parking lot or something, so that the place where he put the second antenna was no longer there.
And here's another question I got for you, Barry. when a normal guy puts a signal on the moon, because the moon is only a half a degree beam width, you'd like to have 50 decibels of gain out of the antenna. That way you encompass, you know, all of your main lobe is on the moon. If he's got a high enough gain and a really sharp beam, he's only lighting up a small section of the moon at one time. Therefore, the total amount of libration fading, the total amount of group delay distortion, in other words, the sub-Earth portion of the moon, the center of the moon, gives you an echo that is some number of microseconds or milliseconds earlier than the perimeter of the moon. And that gives you a kind of audio smearing. I'll bet you when that particular guy with the rhombics was aimed at the moon, I'll bet you his particular sideband sounded a little bit more clean than many of the other sidebands you heard off the moon. That's a guess on my part. I wonder if your experience confirms that, Barry. N2MB, K2LAW.
Absolutely, absolutely. You hit the nail right on the head. And something else that a lot of people don't realize, when you think about it for a second, it makes a lot of sense, but he illuminated less than the entire surface of the moon. So, interestingly enough, he didn't get a louder signal. Once your beam width is the width of the moon, once you make it narrower than that, you'll get less distortion, but your signal will not get any louder. Even if you've doubled your gain, it doesn't get any louder.
Yeah, you're putting the same amount of watts onto the moon, but you're just putting it onto a smaller and smaller section. You're making a hotspot. So when it comes to your transmit power that other people receive, they hear the exact same amount as you go beyond roughly 45 or 50 dB of gain. However, when you're listening to your own echoes, that bigger antenna with a more narrow beamwidth does have a larger capture area, so therefore you're going to hear bigger echoes. So your echo gets louder to you, but other people don't hear the improvement. Moon bounce itself, as you can tell, there's a number of colleges that are experiencing, that are choosing a very high select, high technology group of students and setting up moon bounce experiments, because almost all of the parameters of doing moon bounce are calculatable. How much effective capture area should your receiver have? How much noise figure should the receiver have? How much noise equivalent bandwidth can the receiver have and still get a signal above threshold? How many watts of transmitter power? Your total power spread of power transmitted received. Polarization characteristics, the libration fading of the moon, the depolarization effects from the moon. Also the three-dimensional problem. Let me drop for a second.
You mentioned the valleys and the And things on the moon, in the mountains, so that makes the reflection come back uneven.
It sure does. If your eye operated at radio frequencies and you looked at the moon during a moon bounce experiment, it would be a little bit like looking at an orange that's brightly lit in a dark room, and you're looking at all the pockmarks on the orange, and each one of those little valleys and pockmarks and corner reflectors are all moving with reference to you, because with reference to an earthbound observer, you're on the surface of the earth, and if you were right at the equator, for instance, because of earth rotation, you are moving horizontally close to 1,000 miles an hour. The moon itself is in an elliptical orbit, so there's all kinds of rocking motion going on, where the right-hand side of the moon versus the left-hand side of the moon is moving further or away or closer to you. So all these little hot spots are adding up in a vector manner in a complicated technique, and as such, when you plot signal strength versus time, if your buddy in Japan puts his key down and gives you a steady state carrier and you run your strip shot recorder, you'll see the strip shot recorder jumping all over the place, and you'll wonder where that's coming from. Some of that is the libration fading effect, some of it's the Doppler shift, some of it is the ionospheric characteristics. Even at 2 meters, the ionosphere does rotate polarization. There's ways of calculating that. Some of the smarter guys are using circular polarization to try to get around that. So it's an exact science, believe it or not, whether or not your particular system is capable of giving X number of dB above threshold of moon bounce echo when talking to your buddy. But let me drop a
question.
But even if you and your buddy decide that horizontal linear polarization is the right way to do it, and you sit on the United States and you aim at the moon when it's right straight overhead, and then you aim at the moon with a horizontally polarized signal, and your buddy in Europe is looking at his horizon with a horizontally polarized signal. If you were sitting on the moon and you look back at the guy in Europe and you look at the guy in the United States, because of the round shape of the moon, so to speak, each one of them is transmitting a signal that is parallel to his local terrain. But the terrain in Europe and the terrain in the United States are at a different angle when viewed from the moon. So the word horizontal polarization has a funny meaning when it comes to moon bounce, when you think globally. So there are programs that will...
Yeah, you also ought to try circular polarization. That can really twist your brain up.
Well, circular polarization essentially negates this particular problem I'm now worrying about.
Only if you have a direct reflection. If your antenna is at a slight angle to the moon, it gets all skewed.
Yeah, that's called the axial ratio problem. When you do an axial ratio plot in an anechoic chamber, where you're transmitting with the antenna on the test and you're doing reception with a sensing antenna at the other end of the anechoic chamber, and that sensing antenna is linear polarized and being slowly rotated in polarization, and you're running a strip chart recorder, most antennas will give you very little wiggle when you're near the bore side of the antenna under test. But as you start getting off to the side lobes, you will get a significant amount of axial ratio. So most antennas that claim to be circular polarized are really only circular polarized at the peak of the beam, at bore side.
Also, if you're looking at the moon and you're going up right-handed circular, your reflection is going to be left-handed circular.
Yeah, CP has got some crazy characteristics. A right-hand circular polarized feed horn feeding your parabolic dish, the reflection off the dish becomes left-hand. The left-hand signal hitting the moon reflects off the moon, becomes right-hand. The right-hand signal goes into the dish of the guy you're talking to, reflects off that dish, and that right-hand becomes left-hand, and then it goes into his feed horn. There's all kinds of polarization rotations. You got to make sure you got it all right ahead of time. A couple of guys have recently discovered that they had marginal communication, and because of miscommunication verbally, the guys thought they're both using right-hand circular, and one of them was using left-hand circular. They managed to talk to each other, but at a significant disadvantage. The guys on 10 gigs find out that when you get up that high in frequency, clockwise and counterclockwise, or right-hand and left-hand, almost doesn't matter. The moon does another kind of scrambling of the signal that even messes up clockwise versus counterclockwise, so to speak. Go ahead with your last little question on this one, Wesley. And I'm going to try to look at your most recent email, and we'll discuss it at the end of the TechNet tonight. N2XJM, K2RIW.
Yeah, you were talking about the ionosphere and generally the bandwidth of 450 megahertz up. And I was interested with the electromagnetic waves that are absorbed by the atmosphere due to their wavelength. So you have two components, so responsible for signal absorption. And there would be two components of the atmosphere, like O2 or H2O. Would you please relate your answer to the attenuation pattern to the radio wave versus wavelength of these two components? And to achieve,
when it comes to the frequencies that we amateurs use for moon bounce, 6 meters will give you some ionospheric effects and polarization rotation, Faraday rotation. By the time you get up to 2 meters, 432 and 1296, the atmosphere is almost completely transparent. The very first atmospheric absorption frequency occurs at the water vapor absorption at around 22 gigahertz. Then there's a whole series of oxygen and nitrogen absorption spikes at around 60 gigahertz. And very few of the amateurs have gone that high in frequency yet. So the atmosphere at our radio frequencies is reasonably transparent. The amount of absorption is awfully small until you get up to 22 gigahertz.
How about the rain attenuation?
The raindrops are reasonably reasonably small in wavelength at frequencies like 2 meters, 432, 1296. So the rain attenuation is relatively small. When it comes to the 12 gigahertz satellite receivers that we've used for television reception, our satellite reception systems are, what is that called? I can't even think of the name of the service right now. Anyhow, there you get a depolarization effect, not because of absorption of the atmosphere. You get depolarization because under a heavy rainstorm, the water droplets are no longer completely spherical. Therefore, the frequency reuse scheme that's used for broadcast television at 12 gigahertz, where you've got clockwise and counterclockwise, odd and even transponder numbers with overlapping frequency regions, that's the so-called frequency reuse scheme. On a heavy rainstorm, you'll get a fade-out of your satellite signal, and you think it's due to absorption. It's not due to absorption. Let me drop. The fancy thing that's going on there is that the clockwise signal is being mixed into the counterclockwise signal by way of the raindrops doing cross-polarization coupling, and therefore your poor satellite receiver, which is looking, it thinks it's looking at transponder number 2, but because of the depolarization effect of those raindrops, it is getting some of the energy from the upper end of transponder number 1 and the lower end of transponder number 3 while it's trying to look at transponder number 2, and all of that inter-symbol distortion eventually gets to a certain point where the digital portion of the receiver says, I give up, I can't figure out what's going on, and it gives you a weak apparent signal-to-noise ratio. In reality, the signal you're getting is reasonably strong, but it's contaminated. So until you get to 60 gigs, you don't get these oxygen absorptions, and you do get water vapor absorption, but the first water vapor absorption is around 22 gigs. Very few of the amateurs are up that high in frequency. I'm going to go on to the next person right now, and we'll come back to this one, Wes. And that was KD2CFP, Charlie Mike Papa. Bill, go right ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet.
K2RIW, KD2CFP, thank you, Dick. My question actually goes back to last week's conversation on grounding. One of the best explanations I've heard from Dick. But it is specifically in regards to colors. Okay? All I've read and all I've researched and everything, I don't see how coax operates as far as how much current or how much energy it actually can bring into residents beyond doing damage to a particular radio. You know, are they rated somewhere? Are they spec somewhere? And tell me how much of that lightning strike may piece of LMR 400 actually bring into the house. And that was my question.
Bill, you could use more audio. You could talk a little louder into that mic. I think there may be no exact answer to your question. When it comes to the insertion loss of various transmission lines, decibels of loss per 100 feet, that's pretty well documented. A lightning strike, what frequency range does it have? You could say the main component of the lightning strike acts like it's almost a very fast rise time direct signal. In other words, almost like it's coming from a battery. That's the good news. But it's megavolts at thousands of amperes, with rise time of microseconds, and boy, can it do damage. So any piece of conductor, whether it be a small diameter coax, large diameter coax, hardline, or whatever, if you take a direct strike on your antenna, that cable is capable of bringing a significant amount of energy into your house. And how much energy you can tolerate before it suddenly vaporizes, yeah, the bigger pieces of cable will bring in a larger chunk of energy before it vaporizes. Lightning protection is a difficult area. The good news is that very few of us are going to take a direct strike on our antenna. Even though you and I put up a shiny new antenna that's reasonably expensive and fancy looking, and in our eye, it looks like a real attractor to lightning, and your positive lightning is going to strike it. But if you look a little bit more objectively around your neighborhood, you'll find out there's a tremendous amount of ConEd and LIPA wiring. Those telephone poles, those utility poles with the top wire being grounded are running up and down every one of the streets. You've got this huge grid of conductors around your neighborhood, and that's a much bigger target, and it's much more likely to be struck than your or my particular antenna. I've got 100 feet of tower on 300 feet of land, and you would think I'm being struck all the time, and I've been here for 40 years with that tower. And I think I had a nearby strike once, which gave me some damage.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
So, and, they, and you've been hearing us discuss various grounding techniques, and Glenn, KC2QIQ, who has lived through the lightning capital of the world, Florida, he has a set of opinions which Eric, KE2EJ, slightly agrees with, but they've each got their own slant on it, and that is they prefer significantly grounding systems on the coaxial cables external to the house. They don't want to do the grounding in the house. They want the external, they want those coaxial cables, outer jackets, grounded outside the house with a separate grounding system compared to the equipment in the house. That is their belief as a method of minimizing the amount of damage to the equipment. And if you're a super conservative person, you disconnect all the coax cables going to all of your equipment when you know a thunderstorm is coming.
You also might want to disconnect them from the power lines.
That's another good point. So a really conservative person removes all of his coax cables from the equipment and unplugs all of his equipment from the wall sockets, because there's a much higher probability that the lightning strike will be the power wiring three houses down the block from you, and that spike comes rolling, roaring down that your 110-volt and 240-volt power wiring and comes into the house and does all kinds of damage. And that is the damage that I suffered, the power line damage. Hit my television set and many of my pieces of computer equipment. So, as I said, a super conservative person will do all that. I'm not one who does that. I've never disconnected my coax cables or unplugged my equipment during a thunderstorm, and I sort of have survived that. I think I've experienced some damage from one of my rotators once. None of my radio equipment has experienced damage that I remember. My television set, it did experience damage during a lightning storm. So there's no easy solution. All of the techniques that you use by following all the good books on lightning protection will give you some amount of protection, but nothing is going to be perfect. You'll limit the number of times you experience damage, but in the worst case scenario, you'll never be able to make it go to zero. That's the bad news, Bill, and it's a tough one. KD2, CMP, K2LAW in the TechNet. Joe recognized that Bill first, and Bill, give us a little bit more audio. And Joe, when you come back, you could give us more audio also. Bill first, go ahead.
Thank you for the explanation. I'll stand clear to Joe's question.
And Bill, I'm aware of the fact that we didn't give you a nice, clean, direct answer. There is no nice, clean, simple, direct answer on lightning protection. Each of us have our own theories, philosophies, things that we think work for us, and nothing is perfect. It's a very tough area. The better commercial installations will have